This is Critical Edge. Here we learn how to think, not what to think. Julian Jessop, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
Julian, when's the last time you changed your mind in a significant way?
That's a good question. I think I change my mind fairly often, actually. I often come across a subject and which I might have an instinct to go one way on, and then actually end up going the other. And I often actually take part in debates where I'm invited either to take the yes or the no side, and I find myself willing to take either. So I'd say I change my mind fairly frequently. In fact, there's a famous saying from the economist John Maynard Keynes, you know, when the facts change, I change my mind. What do you do, sir? And I think that's a good approach for many economists and people from other social sciences. We call ourselves social scientists as if there is some sort of fixed science behind all of this, but often there isn't. And certainly any subject that involves people and people's behavior, you have to be willing to accept that people's behavior is often quite unpredictable. So if you have a fixed view on how things are going to work, then often you're going to be proved wrong.
Yeah, well, it's good to hear that you're open-minded and that you change your mind. Obviously, that's something we want to cultivate, right? And often, actually, surprisingly, certain guests we'll have on will say, well, you know, I've sort of hardened into my views and I haven't changed my mind in a while. You've, of course, worked
I must say, that's a general life lesson. That's not obviously relevant to this, but if you take Arsenal Football Club, which is the team that I passionately support, I alternate from time to time from saying we definitely need a new striker to saying actually we're fine because we've got some attacking midfielders who can knock the goals in left, right and centre. So I think it's not just something that applies to sort of work life or academic life, but more generally, you know, new evidence comes along. You need to rethink your model sometimes. You don't necessarily need an outright striker if you've got lots of other players who can score.
Well, football is one of the places, I think, where people are almost the least likely to change their minds, maybe even more than political and economic questions. But to stick to what you're here for, what about in economics in particular? You're generally an advocate for free markets, for small government, and that stayed pretty consistent, which is not a problem. But where's one example where you might have had a significant swing over time in the way you viewed a particular topic, a particular economic topic?
Gosh, it's hard to think of a specific example, but maybe I'll focus on taxation. I have been arguing for some time that we need to have lower taxes. So when, for example, Liz Truss came along and had a sort of program of quite aggressive tax cuts targeting personal income tax, also corporate taxes and other things, I was initially quite positive about that. But what I hadn't really thought through is the broader question of which taxes to cut and why, and also how you do it. So it's all very well saying that you want lower taxes, but realistically, the state needs to raise a certain amount of revenue to do things that even free marketeers like me would say the state has to do. So lots of things like national defense and civil justice and providing a basic welfare safety net that the state has to do. So the money has to come from somewhere. So when you're thinking about cutting taxes, I think you probably need to be more careful than I initially was about thinking through which taxes to cut and why. You know, are you cutting taxes purely to put more money into people's pockets, or are you doing it because you want to change the incentives to spend or invest or to do some things rather than others? And then finally, as I suggested, there's a question of how you do it. It isn't enough just to stand up and cut taxes. You need to properly explain why you're doing it. You probably need fully costed set of policy proposals that have been approved or at least assessed by independent watchdogs like the Office for Budget Responsibility. So I won't say I've changed my view on the need to cut taxes, but I think I've become a bit more nuanced about thinking about which taxes to cut and why, and in particular how.
Yeah, I mean, following from that, which taxes would you say now in 2025, so this is being recorded for those watching in July 2025, which taxes would you think need to be cut?
Okay, well, I'd broaden the question out. I think it's not just a question about the level of taxes. It's also about the complexity of the tax system and the certainty right. around it. I think each of those three dimensions are important and sometimes equally as important. So I would be looking, not necessarily to cut taxes, but to simplify the tax system and also make it more certain. So, for example, I wouldn't have these sort of on and off windfall taxes or potentially a wealth tax that create uncertainty for households and businesses. In terms of the individual taxes that I would cut, I think you want to get rid of taxes that distort economic choices and do so in a way that is damaging to the economy. So you might want to tax some things that are unambiguously bad, like pollution and so on, but you don't want taxes on things like work. If you're trying to encourage people to work, then taxes on jobs are a particularly bad idea. So I'd be looking to reduce taxes on jobs and on investment. If I did need to raise more money through taxation, then I would tend to focus on broad-based taxes that, as I say, distort choices less. Now, one reason I'll be never be elected as a politician is that one thing that I would do is extend value-added tax to food and to children's clothing. Now, I see no good reason why those forms of spending should be exempt. Of course, you might say that poor people spend more on food and children's clothing, but actually that's not necessarily true. And if you do want to support poor people, there are better ways of doing that through the tax and benefit system than exempting all forms of spending on food and children's clothing from VAT. So I will be looking to broaden the tax base, to cut taxes that distort behavior in ways that we don't like, but also to simplify the tax system wherever possible and to make it more consistent over time so that businesses and consumers have a bit more uncertainty about what their tax bills are going to be.
I'm definitely with you on simplifying the tax system. And I think anybody who files their own taxes will also be in agreement that it's unnecessarily complicated. In terms of distinguishing between types of tax, and again, I'm not an expert, one of the distinctions which I'm aware of is between, as I'm sure you know, progressive and regressive taxation. So for our listeners, progressive taxation is taxation which intensifies as you have a higher proportion of wealth or a higher income, and regressive taxation is one which hits lower income or lower wealth people more. Now, you mentioned that it might not help you get elected as a politician. I'm more interested in understanding the mindset behind particularly value-added tax, because it is one of these regressive forms of taxation, right? Where getting taxed on your food is going to be less significant if you're well off, and more significant if you're less well off. Whereas something like a corporation tax, for example, and I don't want to jump into that example too specifically just yet, only impacts you as you begin to do more well. So I wanted to understand how you understand that distinction.
Yeah, well, I think the key point here is that there are always trade-offs in economics. If you want to prioritize having a progressive taxation, then you might get rid of some spending taxes altogether and focus purely on taxes and income and wealth. On the other hand, if you want to raise taxes in ways that, you know, maybe don't distort the economy so much, then you might prefer spending taxes that, you know, don't discourage people from earning more money, but, you know, does take money out when they actually come and spend it. And that can actually be quite positive for incentives to work and to save and to invest. So there are always trade-offs here. But I would say we do actually have overall a relatively progressive tax system. And I think it's really important to look at taxes in the round rather than every individual tax, because obviously some taxes will be more progressive than others. It's the overall interaction of all taxes and benefits that I think matter. So when I was talking about extending VAT to food and children's clothing, I was careful to say that you might want to partly offset that elsewhere in the tax and benefit system. For example, you know, making benefits more generous to protect the most vulnerable. But if you simply look at each individual tax and try and say, is that more progressive or less progressive, then I think you miss that bigger picture. And there is a danger that you end up with an overall tax system that actually doesn't achieve all the different aims that you want a tax system to achieve.
Okay, yeah, thank you. That's very clarifying. I guess I want to ask about this phrase you've used a couple of times, distort the economy. It seems to be related to incentives, but maybe you could unpack that a little bit for our listeners and what you mean exactly by that.
Yeah. Well, ideally, you want the tax system to be neutral. In other words, it starts from the point of view that you don't want to encourage people to do one thing rather than another. There are exceptions to that, of course, in both directions. So there are some sorts of activity that have sort of negative impacts on other people, which aren't necessarily reflected in the prices that people pay. So a perfect example of that is pollution. So if you know the price of fuel, if it were just determined by the market, would probably be too low, because it wouldn't reflect the additional social costs of me driving my car and polluting the atmosphere and creating congestion from other people. So there's a good case to set an additional tax to reflect the amount of pollution that an activity is causing. So in the economic jargon, that's known as a negative externality. So that's one example where you might want to set a tax that does distort activity. Sort of like it encourages people to pollute the environment less by making driving more expensive than it would otherwise have been. There are also some things you might want to encourage because they have positive externalities of one type or another. So you might want to do something that encourages people to save and invest, because that might be good for the economy. You know, the extra investment produces more, you know, capital in the economy, boosts productive potential and does positive things there. So there are some exceptions where you might want the tax system to encourage or discourage certain types of activity. But generally speaking, you want to just simply raise money in ways that don't distort people's choices. And a broad-based expenditure tax is actually quite good at that. It doesn't affect people's decisions to save or invest or to work. And it affects all spending equally. So it doesn't encourage one type of spending over another, which is part of the problem with the current system. So in short, you want a tax system that is neutral as far as possible for people's choices, unless you've got a very specific reason for wanting them to do one thing rather than another.
Thank you. Let's talk about incentives then. You've mentioned that you don't want to disincentivize picking up wealth. And insofar as that statement is true, I tend to agree. Just one way I think I would push back slightly is sort of with comparison to other countries outside of the UK. You've mentioned, for example, an opposition very recently to increasing corporation tax in the UK. And I don't want to focus in on one thing too much, but this is more of a general point. Other countries such as Japan, for example, which have higher corporation tax by a significant margin. I think they have circa 30 and we have circa 19 currently. Outperform us, and the same is true for other countries which also have progressive taxation in that sort of way, like for example in the Scandinavian countries, which have a very progressive tax system in terms of costing more the higher you go up. It doesn't seem to disincentivize hard work and earning money to tax when you're doing so. What sort of data would you point to, or points would you make?
Well, there's a lot to unpick there. First of all, I think actually the main rate of corporation tax in the UK is now 25%, so it's probably a bit closer to the average. There's a general problem though with corporation tax. People think of taxes on businesses as being different from taxes on people and on working people in particular. That's not actually correct. Businesses themselves are just sort of legal constructs. The economic burden of taxation is always borne by real people. So if you raise tax on a company, that tax will ultimately be paid for by people. Now, it might be that they're the shareholders of that company, in the form of lower profits and lower dividends, in which case you could argue that shareholders tend to be richer than the average. So that's fair enough. That's still a progressive tax. But in many other cases, the burden might be borne by the people who work for the company in the form of lower pay or fewer jobs. Or it might be borne by the customers of the company who might have to pay higher prices, or the company might simply go bust and not provide the goods and services that people want. So I think there's a sort of false distinction here between taxes on companies and taxes on people. You know, ultimately, it's always people that pay taxes, and just shuffling the burden onto companies doesn't necessarily help. In terms of specific examples of where high levels of corporate taxation have backfired, I think a very good example is the so-called energy profits levy, which is a windfall tax on the profits being made by UK North Sea oil and gas companies. Now, that creates a marginal tax rate of more than 70% on revenues that are raised from North Sea oil and gas. Now, you might think that's a good thing, but all the evidence is that it isn't, for a number of reasons. Well, one is it's discouraging investment in oil and gas in the North Sea, which means that we're more dependent on oil and gas imported from other countries who may not be as squeaky clean on the environmental aspects of that, or, you know, dodgy countries in the Middle East. It also, of course, you know, costs jobs. You know, you're a pretty brave person going into a pub in Aberdeen or Inverness saying that you support the energy profits levy, given the damage it's caused to the industry there. So that's a good example of a tax that I think is the wrong side of the line. Another good example, actually, is the taxation of cigarettes. I'm not a smoker myself, but I'm assured that, you know, a legitimate packet of cigarettes now costs something like £15 because of the very high levels of tobacco tax. Now, again, that might be good if you want to discourage people from smoking, but what it actually seems to do in practice is encourage people to buy illicit tobacco that hasn't been taxed from the local vape shop or dodgy barbers. So it's losing money for the exchequer. It's creating criminality. And these cigarettes, because they're illicit, are often substandard. So there are lots of examples I could give where, you know, tax has been too high, both in terms of, you know, actually raising less money than it otherwise have done, but also encouraging the wrong sorts of behavior and actually being counterproductive in that way.
Yeah, thanks. I think there's a lot to tackle there. I'll just maybe focus on the last thing you mentioned, which is tobacco. I think that's the one point which strikes me. Surely less people buying tobacco is a result of higher tax, higher prices on tobacco. Or do you disagree with that?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's part of the factor. I mean, you're assuming, of course, that that's a good thing. Now, I understand why people think that is a good thing. I personally think it should be up to people to make their own choices about whether they smoke or not.
Now, is it the same case for drugs, would you say? Just to make a quick jump in. Would you say it's the same thing?
Yeah, I'm somebody who probably would legalize most drugs.
Fair enough. Fair
because
enough. Okay.
Just simply to understand. Because the war on drugs isn't working. I mean, I'm not a fan of most illegal drugs, or probably any. I mean, even cannabis, so I'm probably not keen on. That's the only, I think, illegal drug I've actually ever had, because I think that does have serious negative effects. But that's not necessarily a case for making it illegal. I think it's a case for regulating it properly and maybe taxing it properly in the case of cannabis as well. But there's, again, the broader issue here is the extent to which it's the state's role to tell people what to do. Now, if something is harmful only for the person concerned and they're fully aware of the risks, then I think they should be allowed to just get on with it. Now, there are some question marks there. For example, there are certain sort of addictive things that people might start doing and then lose the agency to control what they're doing, and those you might want to regulate. But if smoking was only hurting the person that is involved, then I wouldn't see any case for regulation or excess taxation. That, of course, isn't quite the case because you have things like secondary smoking. But apart from that, I think the case for taxing tobacco as high as we do is actually pretty weak. Now, at this point, some people say, well, what about the external costs, for example, to the NHS? But actually, there's a lot of evidence that people who smoke, that activity actually saves the NHS or the public purse more generally money, because they tend to die earlier of smoking-related conditions, and they don't spend as long in retirement drawing down on the state pension. So actually, if you're making an argument purely on financial grounds, which I wouldn't, but if you were, I think the state should be far more relaxed about smoking than it actually is.
Just to, could you clarify that position in terms of, the financial one that you just mentioned? Would you say it is a good thing for the NHS that people smoke because they die earlier, therefore it's better for the, let's say, that state in general, in terms of overall utility?
Yeah, I wouldn't make that argument myself because that sounds a bit callous, but I would use that as a counter argument. So when people say smoking is bad,
if it is used as a counter argument, would you back that counter argument?
Well, put it like this: if somebody says to me, we should tax smoking heavily or ban it outright because it costs the NHS a lot of money, I would simply respond by saying that's not true, because people who smoke die earlier and end up saving the Exchequer money. But I wouldn't lead with that argument, because, I mean, that's an argument for all sorts of things. It's not exact comparison, but that's an argument for encouraging assisted dying, for example, because, you know, people would then save the state money. I don't think that could be your first argument, but I would deploy it as a counter argument to those people who are arguing that you need to ban smoking in order to save money.
Right, so it'd just be a response to the specific point, this saves money, without saying that it in itself it's a reason. No,
I'm not going to go out and encourage people to smoke because I think it saves the state money. That's the point I'm making. I think it should be people's choice to decide whether or not to smoke, as long as the prices that they pay reflect any external costs, as long as their activity doesn't inflict harm on others. So, for example, passive smoking, I think it's perfectly reasonable to be worried about that.
Yeah. I tend to see, and we'll move on shortly from tobacco. I think there's only so much we can say here, but I tend to see, you know, for example, in France, where taxation is lower on tobacco and there's much less restrictions on where you can smoke, although that has changed very recently. The smoking rate is significantly higher with lower regulation. I do think that correlation is quite strong, and I'm not so sure that, unless you'd like to correct me perhaps with some specific statistics, you know, I have a lot of friends who smoke, and I've never really heard of anyone buying illegal tobacco for price reasons. I'm not sure how present that potential economy actually is.
Oh, well, it is very, very common. There was a recent BBC Insight story about this that you can find on their website. I mean, you would have seen the big rise in the number of, you know, so-called vape shops and, you know, questionable barbers, and a lot of that is to do with illegal activity, including under the counter sales of cigarettes. So it's undoubtedly a problem. And I think HMRC themselves estimate that they lose billions of pounds every year to sales of illegal tobacco. Also, it's not just a phenomenon in the UK. It's a big issue in many other countries. Again, if you Google the tobacco industry in Australia, there's large amounts of crime that is linked to illicit, untaxed tobacco. So it's definitely a problem, and it's easy to find evidence of that online.
Okay, thank you. Let's talk about Brexit. You've been a big advocate for Brexit for a long time, primarily for economical reasons, although, of course, I think from a libertarian point of view, you're sort of against the strength of regulation that the EU has over us. Has your view on Brexit changed? Not to say that you don't support it anymore, but in terms of the economical argument, how has that evolved and adapted as we've seen it play out?
Okay. Well, why am I a supporter of Brexit, despite everything that's happened? I'm still a supporter of Brexit because I fundamentally believe that, you know, nation states are better at making decisions about domestic regulation and about foreign trade than big blocs are, like the European Union. Now, that's not a consensus view, actually, even amongst free market economists. I mean, plenty of, you know, libertarian or classical liberal economists would argue that the European Union is actually a good thing because it constrains the hands of national governments to do stupid things. And also that the EU as a bloc might be better at regulating because of economies of scale and better at doing trade deals. So I certainly would not say that Brexit is a free market project, because there are plenty of free marketeers who would argue the EU actually works quite well in that direction. In terms of the impact of Brexit to date, clearly the initial impact has been negative. And actually a number of people, including me, who are supportive of Brexit, thought that would be the case, because initially the two main things you do is you increase uncertainty that obviously is bad for investment, but also you disrupt trading relations and labour market flows with our biggest single trading partner. So the initial impact of Brexit was always likely to be negative, and I think it's reasonable to say that you can see that in the data. But I think the impact has been far smaller than many people suggest. I see lots of figures in the hundreds of billions in terms of the cost of the economy, or 4 or 5% of GDP. But in fact, the impact has been, I think, much smaller than that. Certainly look at the trade numbers. It's not clear there's been a massive impact. Investment has been relatively weak, but I would link that to the initial uncertainty around Brexit rather than something that's a permanent shock. So over time, I think the initial costs of Brexit will diminish. More importantly, the benefits will start to increase. We're certainly not at that point now. If you did a cost-benefit analysis now, the impact of Brexit would undoubtedly be negative. But over time, I think the scope to do, you know, better free trade deals with the rest of the world and lower some of those regulatory burdens at home will turn out to be a positive. But we're talking here, you know, many years and potentially decades before I could definitively stick my hand up and say Brexit has definitely been a success. And of course, that also depends on the government of the day being willing to make those choices. And there are lots of people, even actually Brexit supporters, who wanted Brexit to be used as an opportunity to increase state intervention. So, for example, more, you know, state subsidies, more intervention in areas that the EU actually prevented governments from doing. So, again, that's a good example of how Brexit itself is not necessarily a free market project. Lots of people on the left of the Labour Party supported it because they wanted the state to get bigger rather than be subject to more control from Brussels.
Is it not, to some extent, still the case that while the UK trades with the EU, like you mentioned, the biggest trade partner of the UK, the UK is still subject to those regulations, except now they don't have any hand in regulating
them
themselves.
Well, they shouldn't be. But we actually have a relatively liberal free trade agreement now with the European Union. So we have tariff-free trade, we have quota-free trade. As long as the goods that we produce can meet the rules for origin, the technical rules set down by the European Union. So in principle, we can diverge on regulations if we want to. But that does carry a cost because even though we don't have tariff barriers, we do have what are called non-tariff barriers to our trade with the European Union. So they insist on all sorts of, in my view, completely unnecessary checks on the safety of goods made in the UK. So even though our standards are basically the same or even better, we still have these non-tariff checks that slow trade down. So there is a big debate about whether we should realign more closely with the European Union in order to reduce those non-tariff barriers. Now, my answer to that question is a definite no, because the closer we are aligned to the European Union rules, then partly we run into the problem that you identified. We have to align with rules that we ourselves have had no say in designing. But there's a more general problem that the European Union does tend to over-regulate. I think this is a widely recognized problem. Even sort of firm supporters of the European Union, like the Italian Mario Draghi, have written about how the EU's rules impose all sorts of additional barriers to trade within the bloc that slow growth. So if we signed up to EU rules, not only would we have no say in what those rules are, but often those rules are actually pretty bad. And there are plenty of examples I could give in areas like financial services or biosciences or potentially in future the regulation of AI, where I think the EU is going to over-regulate and hold back productivity and growth. Whereas we in the UK at least have the potential to do things better, though whether any government really has the nous to do that, I think is debatable.
Right, so we began in the European Union with free trade with the EU, and in general, the EU does tend to have pretty free trade outside of the EU as well. So then does the economic benefit just come from the lack of regulation as we trade with other people?
Well, no, I challenge you there. And the EU is actually one of the world's biggest protectionist blocs. So it has free trade within the EU, but imposes all sorts of barriers on trade with the rest of the world. So the EU doesn't have any form of meaningful trade deal with the EU or with the EU, starting with the US or many countries in the developing world, including, you know, faster growing economies like China and India. So actually the EU, I think, is actually very much a very large protectionist bloc. It's terribly slow at doing trade deals as well, not least because it requires, you know, all 27 national governments to be in agreement. Sometimes regional governments have a say as well. So the EU is reasonably good at lowering trade barriers within the EU, but at the cost of erecting substantial trade barriers with the rest of the world. And if I were to pick an early Brexit benefit, for example, it's the fact that the UK has been able to do actually quite a limited trade deal with Trump's United States of America. But at least we've been able to do that more quickly than the European Union has, that is still facing higher tariffs for the foreseeable future.
So let's talk about the political impacts then. In fairness, I do see your point about sort of trade from outside the protectionist bloc. You're also opposed to membership of the EU insofar as it affects regulation, political control, and so on. Can you give some explicit examples of where there's a tangible impact of the sort of legislation that the EU might pass, not only just economically, but also as it relates to domestic politics?
Well, here's one I think should appeal to everybody, whatever your political views, which is animal welfare standards. So there's all these suggestions that when the UK left the EU, we would lower animal welfare standards, and that'll be bad for everybody, but the animals in particular. That simply hasn't happened. What's actually happened is that we've tightened animal welfare standards in a number of areas, like live exports of animals. Certain types of fishing have now been banned. So there's this perception that the European Union is lovely, fluffy, and wonderful, but actually in lots of areas we've actually improved animal welfare standards as a result of leaving the European Union, which correspondingly is at risk if we now tie ourselves again to EU regulations, particularly if we've got no say in them. Now, that's animal welfare, but I could choose lots of examples from things like the financial services world, where EU regulations have been far too strict. And artificial intelligence, another example. Interestingly, President Macron of France himself has flagged up concerns that the EU's instincts will be to overregulate AI and given even bigger competitive advantage to the US in particular, but to countries like the UK that might be more favourable towards the adoption of new technology. So that's a sort of a big example potentially for the next few decades, is the UK, I think, has a significant advantage over the EU in terms of developing AI, as long as we remain outside the control of Brussels.
Right, with terms of regulation of AI, what do you think the strongest argument is for less regulation? Obviously, in general, along all your viewpoints, there seems to be a trend of, less regulation is better. Do you not think that, let's say, regulation of AI can be very helpful, especially in preserving jobs and for the creative industry?
Well, that's two quite different things. First of all, in terms of protecting the creative industry, then actually I'm with you on that, because there's a fundamental issue here of property rights that are essential to the fair working of a market economy. So if AI allows people to scrape off other people's data and intellectual property and music being a prime example of that, then me as a free marketeer am opposed to that. Okay. The jobs question, though, is more nuanced. And of course, we've been here many times before. In every single industrial revolution, people have said we need to protect jobs. So, when more efficient weaving machines came along, people rioted because they wanted to protect cottage industries of, people producing woven cloth from home incredibly inefficiently, but those jobs were considered worth protecting. And whole mechanization and modernization of manufacturing is being resisted at pretty much every single stage. In all of those previous episodes, obviously some jobs were lost, but others were created to fill their place. And those jobs that were created were often significantly better in some sense, shorter hours, safer, higher paid, more rewarding in all sorts of different ways. And if I could just choose, again, one example from my experience. When I started work at the Treasury back in, 1987, we had a typing pool. And what that meant in practice was it used to handwrite all your notes and memos. It used to be walked around by a messenger, given to a typing pool of, as it happens, invariably young women, whose job was to write that up. And then they'd send it back to you. And then you'd edit it and go backwards and forwards. Now, of course, those jobs no longer exist. We do not have, as far as I'm aware, typing pools anymore. But those people have been freed up to do far more productive things. Or if we go back a little bit further, 100 or 150 years ago, a very significant proportion of the population of this country were employed in domestic service of one type or another. And in practice, that often meant hand washing things. But of course, now we don't need to do that because we've got washing machines and tumble dryers and that sort of thing. And the people who benefited most from that, I would suggest again, young women who traditionally would have been doing those roles. So it's been hugely positive for, you know, social equality and progression of women and protection of young people that we have adopted technology rather than resisting them. Admittedly, AI, I think, is potentially different. It's not just doing mechanical things better than humans can. In many ways, it's replacing them by doing thinking better, or at least more quickly than humans can. So I do accept that the jobs risk is potentially bigger this time around. But I still go back to the historical precedent that every other innovation has ended up leaving society as a whole better off. We just need to make sure we've got means in place to protect the potential losers, in particular through things like retraining or reskilling, whatever else that is they need to do to do well in the new society or the new economy.
Yeah, I think I'll pass it to Ollie, but just as a brief acceptance of your general point, I think you're right in that I think over-regulation is probably not a good idea in terms of the EU falling behind. But I do think, you know, caution should be definitely taken, because I think, as we've seen with nuclear arms war, racing with other countries for technological development can have its dangers. And like we mentioned as well, you've got dangers of creative jobs being in risk, and I think AI is also fundamentally and inherently different to things like washing clothes, as you also pointed out. But we can leave that one there. I'll pass on to Ollie, and he'll wrap this up for today.
Yeah, so I just wanted to quickly talk about AI regulation as it relates to safety. Now, insofar as it goes with the markets and stuff, I wouldn't pretend to be sufficiently expert in order to predict the impact on jobs. And I think, given the radical nature of it, it's very difficult to predict. For me, the regulation of AI is something like a collective action problem. So for our listeners, a collective action problem is a problem of getting individuals to work in a way that's collectively beneficial, where if those individuals don't work together, they'll all choose what's best for them, but that turns out overall worse. Now, I think with AI regulation, we have this kind of race, because the more you regulate, the less you take from the benefits of AI. And yet the less you regulate, the more danger there is. Now, if you could regulate for AI safety globally, it would take away this problem. And so is the problem with the EU overregulating more so a collective action problem rather than the EU specifically doing wrong for regulating and making sure that safety is in place?
Well, I'm wary of any suggestion that we have sort of global agreement on these things for two reasons. First of all, frankly, they tend not to work. You only need a few countries that don't sign up or who cheat for a collective agreement to be impossible. And certainly in the current climate, it's going to be very difficult for the US to do an agreement on these things, say with China or India. But the second problem I've got with these sort of collective agreements is it sort of assumes that one solution fits all and we know what that solution is. Whereas if you have what I might call a sort of free-for-all, then different countries can try different things. We can find out which works and which doesn't. So, you know, if we take the issue of regulation generally, the US tends to have a fairly light touch system of regulation, but very strong penalties through the legal system and through the markets if people do things badly. So in the US, I mean, it's super litigious. And, you know, if you produce a product that's dangerous, you can be sued for millions or billions of dollars. That, by and large, tends to work pretty well. In the European Union, though, in particular, there's more of an approach sometimes described as the precautionary principle, which is if in doubt, ban it from the outset. So you don't get that sort of experiment. You don't get, you know, the market trying what works and being punished very heavily if it gets things wrong. So, and generally speaking, I prefer that US model to the European Union model. So that's one example which I think explains why the US has been far more successful in these areas, including AI and IT more generally than Europe has, because they're just allowed to go ahead and make their mistakes and correct them later.
Julian Jessop, thanks very much for joining us. For those listening, please leave your thoughts below. What did you think of the episode? Should AI be regulated? Like and subscribe and join us next time. Thank you very much. Thanks, Julian.